Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's Friday. We'll take your calls for our Week in Review. On Seth Moulton ending his presidential run.
I am leaving this race knowing that we raised issues that are vitally important to the American people and our future.
And the crisis of confidence and corruption in Massachusetts government, from the RMV to the state police.
We believe Pullman wielded the union like a criminal enterprise, running it like an old school mob boss, conspiring with Lynch to steal tens of thousands of dollars from its members and the Commonwealth.
Plus, there's coral in New England, and it might help teach us how tropical coral can survive climate change.
When we started working on this coral, and still, although less so now, people would be like, what? A stranger what? A stranger who? What are you saying? There's a coral in New England?
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so it's time for our Week in Review, starting with Congressman Seth Moulton, who announced today that he's dropping out of the 2020 presidential race after 4 months. He spoke earlier today at the Democratic National Committee meeting in San Francisco. Here's sound from Now This Politics.
I want to use this opportunity with all of you here to announce that I am ending my campaign for president. Though this campaign is not ending the way I had hoped, I am leaving this race knowing that we raised issues that are vitally important to the American people and our future.
Moulton is the fourth candidate to drop out of a crowded Democratic field. Now his focus will be his re-election bid for his congressional seat here in the Commonwealth. One possible challenger for his seat, gun violence activist Angus McQuilkin, says Massachusetts voters want a representative who will be present in their communities.
They want a congressman who will spend their time fighting against President Trump instead of fighting against other Democrats, and who will focus on the job they have rather than the job that they want.
We turn first to WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who's been following this story as it unfolds and joins us now from New York. Kimberly, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And you?
I'm great.
Good. And you listeners, what do you think of Seth Moulton dropping out? Do you think other candidates will or need to follow suit? Is Massachusetts losing something without him in the race? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Kimberly, Seth Moulton spoke earlier, as we said, at the Democratic National Convention's summer meeting in San Francisco. What did he tell the crowd about why he's dropping out?
Well, he said that, you know, it wasn't the race he wanted to run, but that he got out important issues that he was hoping to get out in terms of a service and wanting to create a moral leadership that was different than what we have under Donald Trump. I don't know if you could hear it clearly in the clip you played, though. When he said he was dropping out, there was actually a splattering of applause in the room.
Yes, one could hear that, which is striking.
Which I don't think was the response he was hoping for,
yeah.
But I think it's emblematic of the fact that since he got into the race, he just never really seemed to find a constituency. He never really found a lane or folks who got very excited about his candidacy. It was hard because there were a lot of people in the race. He got in later than other folks. He said it was because of his new baby daughter who was born, and he wanted to spend time with her before jumping in.
I think she's 10 months old now, is that right?
10 months old now. And so, you know, there were factors against him, but at the end of the day, he just never really seemed to resonate with the crowd. He never qualified for any of the debates. And it was a really tough, long shot of long shots to begin with. So
okay.
I think he read the writing on the wall.
So, Kimberly, you've said, you know, he never really got traction. It's kind of been like this for him from the beginning. So what brought him to this conclusion now versus last week or next week?
Yeah, I mean, the two biggest things that can get people out of a race early is a lack of money, and he has not seen anywhere near the fundraising numbers that other candidates have seen, and just a lack of strong support. He has never polled even at 1% in a lot of these polls. He's never raised a great deal of money. And so it was just really unfeasible for him to stay in. There was really no lane. And for him to remain in the office he has, I think he realized now that he really needs to focus on that reelection effort, especially since there will likely be several challengers in the Democratic primary trying to unseat him, especially given this, like the clip you played from Angus McQuilkin. A lot of people in the district are unhappy with his efforts to try to prevent Nancy Pelosi from becoming speaker. And they don't like the fact that he's seen as battling other Democrats rather than having the eye on the prize of President Trump.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. What do you think of Seth Moulton's candidacy for the presidency of the United States? And was it time for him to withdraw, or would you have liked to have seen him stay in? Let's bring in our Week in Review panelists now. Here with us in Studio 3 is Renee Graham. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Also with us is Joe Battenfeld. He's the political columnist. I always do that. I cannot say that word. Political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome back.
So you got Battenfeld right. That's the most important thing.
There you go. All right, let me just ask the two of you. What are your reactions to this news today? Either one of you.
I don't know. I think it says a lot about Seth Moulton that the only real news he made with his campaign was ending it.
Ow. Yeah.
At this point in the campaign, more people know John Delaney than recognize Seth Moulton's name. Seth Moulton's been a U.S. congressman for quite a while now. He, you know, as Kimberly said, he never got traction. He never made it to the debate stage. And I really think overall, he's had a rough year. And I think, starting the year off with the problems with Nancy Pelosi and trying this coup and it failing, he came off looking really sort of confused and weak. And I think that hurt him in his presidential bid.
So, Kimberly, let me just ask you quickly, is there still a long tail on his challenge to Nancy Pelosi in Washington? Has that hurt him there?
Yes, it has. When he launched his presidential run, I talked to a lot of Democrats and Democratic staffers on the Hill, and there was a lot of eye rolling. People really didn't understand what he was trying to do. There are still a lot of hard feelings, even among people who don't necessarily believe that Nancy Pelosi should be speaker indefinitely, didn't really like the way that Seth Moulton went about it. He didn't earn himself a lot of friends in Washington, and I think the big question is, has he hurt himself among his constituency within his district in a way that's going to make reelection difficult?
So, Joe, Renee said earlier, this is the biggest news he's made since he entered the race. About 2 years ago, Politico ran this huge feature on him. Is this the next big guy? Is this a future president of the United States? What happened?
I don't know. He certainly had the ego to run, that's for sure. But he had no real record of accomplishment to speak of. He was only in there for 3 terms, and he didn't have anything that he passed, any great bill that he passed. And the reality is that there is no room in this race for a moderate like him. And that's what he said on his way out, by the way, in his interviews today. He said basically it's become a 3-person race between Warren, Biden, and Sanders, and that there's no room for a moderate, which is true.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Emily from Cambridge. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and say, honestly, I saw Seth Moulton speaking in person in committee meetings a couple years ago in Washington, and I was just super impressed. I was working in Beverly at the time, really proud to have him representing us. But I was very excited when he got into the race that it's time. He didn't make it onto the debate stages, and that had me worried. I was donating to his campaign, and I will be more than excited to do so again in the future. But I think the writing was on the wall, unfortunately. I think I remember him announcing the same day that Joe Biden ended up announcing, and that was just kind of a gut punch from the very get-go. So like you're saying about him not finding a lane, I hope he does in a few years. I will be totally on board, but this is not the time.
Emily,
I'm glad he's making a mature choice.
When you
now
say gut punch, you mean that you thought he didn't stand a chance once Biden announced at the same time? Is that what you're saying?
Normally when a new contender gets into the race, and I think he was pretty popular at home at the time, I found him super impressive. That makes a headline, and it just had no chance of getting any traction in the news cycle because of, you know, the coincidental timing and being, you know, number 18 or 19 okay. or okay. 40 in the race.
Thanks for that, Emily. So, Renee, I want to play a cut from Seth Moulton when we talked to him just last month about his presidential run.
I think what we need to do to beat Donald Trump is find a nominee who can truly bring this country together, not only to win the election, to build the diverse coalition of Democrats, of independents, those Obama-Trump voters, and even disaffected Republicans that we need to beat a sitting president, but also bring the country together to accomplish things once that's done.
Okay, so that is a moderate message. And as Joe just said, maybe no room in the Democratic primaries for a moderate. Yet Emily says, well, you got somebody like Biden entering. That kind of sounds like what people are saying they think Biden can do. So is he right? Is Moulton right about what the party needs? And if it's not Moulton, who is it?
You know, I mean, Moulton could only run as a moderate. That's who he is. And that's fine. But I'm not sure it's the time for that. You know, I think the Democrats need to be Democrats again and embrace their progressive values. And, you know, Seth Moulton was going to play it safe. I don't think that, and especially in a crowded field, he had any way of distinguishing himself. You know, there might be something to be said for the message he has, and ultimately we'll see what the party does next year. But for right now, the passion wasn't there for him because I think the party wants something else.
So that's really striking to me. And Joe, I'll turn the question to you. I read the Globe story about this today, and one of the things that it talked about was Moulton's belief that his deep experience in the U.S. military, juxtaposed to President Donald Trump, would give him a real advantage. Why is not even his military service a way to distinguish him? Why is it so hard for him to set himself out separately?
Because Democrats, you know, Democratic voters don't feel that that's that important a qualification to be running for president. There's not, he was the only one. He's the only one in the field who is a veteran like that, who is just, I think he was the only one who was just coming out of service. And, there's Tulsi Gabbard as well. But, you know, the reality is there's not a lot of military experience up there. And it would have helped the Democratic nominee to have that in a general election, but it's not helping him in the primaries.
Renee, you were shaking your head about something.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is also a veteran. So juxtapose those two campaigns. How does the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana get more traction than a U.S. congressman?
How does he? How did that happen?
And right. He barely has more traction right now, by the way. He doesn't have a lot of traction currently.
Right, but he's certainly gotten more headlines and more attention than Seth Moulton ever got. So, you know, what was the difference there? Well, and I think there was a way that Buttigieg was energizing certain parts of the electorate that Seth Moulton just couldn't reach.
Joe, you were going to say something.
I think Buttigieg was helped by getting a lot of media exposure. He got in the race early, got a lot of media exposure, and got helped by the debates. The thing that really killed Moulton was he wasn't allowed in the debates. And I agree with him. I don't think it's fair that he just because he didn't raise enough money that he should be not allowed in the debates. You're reinforcing the idea that money is the only thing that matters in this race. And it's true in the Democratic race. And I just don't think it's fair that he was kept out of the debates.
Yeah, I do agree with Joe on that. I think if you were running, you had a right to be on the debate stage.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can call and share your thoughts on Seth Moulton pulling out of the presidential race. Or think ahead, because in a minute we're going to start talking about the fictional maybe primary between Kennedy and Markey. But before we go to that, I want to play one more clip. This is Moulton today talking about what comes next for him in presidential 2020. Let's listen.
As a party, we need to spend these next months doing everything we can to determine who our strongest nominee will be. And as we do so, we can't be distracted by the latest outrage on Twitter or the reality show politics of the day.
So he went on to say that he would campaign his backside off for whoever is actually the nominee. And I think my question is, we've got two things rolling at the same time. We have a Democratic presidential primary rolling, and we have a Republican who is already running a general election campaign. There's a struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party during the primary season that is significantly more progressive. What do we do about this? Kimberly?
Yeah, look, I think I'm in the camp that I think a robust primary is not a bad thing. Keep in mind, this is still really early. It is the summer in the year before the election. This time in, you know, before 2008 and 2007, this time, people were barely getting to know who this Barack Obama person was. There were people saying that he wasn't electable. It is really early. And I think the Democratic Party has been wrestling with a lot of these policy issues. What should health care look like? What should gun control look like? What should immigration policy look like? And they're hashing this out and they're talking to voters. And I think that that's it is a useful exercise for the Democratic nominee if they're going to come out and be able to get enough votes, get enough support from the party at large to carry the mantle to be the nominee. So in that sense, I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing. And I don't think we really know how progressive the base is yet. I don't think the candidates even know. They're trying to put their best message out there. So one thing Seth Moulton is saying is he stopped short of endorsing Joe Biden and declaring this a three-way race between Biden, Sanders, and Warren, which is interesting since Warren is from his home state. But he really gave this idea that he believes that the party's messaging for things like Medicare for All and other things that he did not back is going too far to the left. And he thinks that that will make it harder to beat Donald Trump. I think the answer is we really don't know yet.
All right. So let's stay with the subject of 2020. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey might have another primary challenger for the Massachusetts election in 2020. Multiple reports are suggesting that Congressman Joe Kennedy III is considering a run. Now, he does have two challengers already, lawyer Shannon Liss Reardon, who I always want to say Reardon. It's not. It's Reardon. And author and businessman Steve Pemberton. They've already declared. Is this a good move for Kennedy, Joe, to have it out there that he's thinking about challenging Markey?
I don't think it's ultimately a good move. I think what we've seen in the last few days is a backlash against Kennedy. We've seen liberal groups, environmental groups come out and endorse Ed Markey, which is amazing. Usually when a Kennedy says, I'm interested in this race, people kind of move aside and let him or her into the race. This has not been the case this time with Markey. And I've spoken to some activists who are very upset with Kennedy, actually, and feel that he is doing the party a disservice and doing Ed Markey a disservice by putting this out that he's interested in running.
Well, Ed Markey seemed to kind of anticipate this and held in his pocket an endorsement video from Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Let's hear just a little bit from that.
We need Ed Markey in the Senate to keep our country and our Commonwealth moving forward. Ed is my friend and my partner in the Senate. I've got his back, and I know that he will always have yours.
Renee, it's not even a race yet, and there's almost this tinge of nasty going on this early on. Is this good or bad for the Massachusetts Democratic Party?
Well, I do find it interesting to see that the Kennedy name doesn't hold the same currency in Massachusetts that it once did. You know, there's once this idea that, well, once a Kennedy's in the race, that's it. It belongs to them. And this is a different generation. This is a different era. So I think that's a bit of a, you know, a splash of cold water in maybe Joe Kennedy's face. I also think it's interesting. Ed Markey had to know this was coming. You know, he looked and realized how vulnerable incumbents were last fall. And so he did smart things, like aligned himself with Congresswoman AOC from New York with the Green New Deal. So, you know, he doesn't look like he's this dusty old politician somehow hanging on for dear life. He's aligning himself with more progressive colleagues, and I think that's helping him. And I think that's why you have this sort of backlash of people feeling like, well, what's wrong with Ed Markey? Why do we need Joe Kennedy III?
Let's take a quick call. Al from Sterling, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Yes, I think three things quickly. First, the Democrats got to get together and put together a platform that can win the presidential election. They're just going in every direction you can go in. Secondly, we, during the primaries, Democrats have to pick the person who has the best chance of beating Trump. And I really don't care what his platform is. I just want someone to beat Trump. Thirdly, they've got to stop picking on each other in these debates. They beat up Obama worse than they did Trump during the debate. It's crazy.
Al, thanks for that call, Al. Kimberly, so Al's talking about tension, infighting, disagreements in the platform. We've just been talking about a local race, Kennedy Markey. I do want to ask, is Washington aware of what's happening here in Massachusetts? And is this endemic of a larger kind of internal challenging that's happening in the party?
I think it's absolutely true. I think it's happening simultaneously nationally as well as within states like Massachusetts. I mean, yes, I'm going to say again with this race or potential race, it's also really early, and everything that Joe and Renee said is absolutely true in that this won't be a cakewalk for Joe Kennedy or anything or anybody else. But I also say I think about the candidacies of people like Ayanna Pressley, who also angered a lot of people when she launched her challenge against Mike Capuano, a longtime and very much liked, even within his district, congressman, who she managed to defeat handily. This isn't just about policy. If it was just about policy, there's not a ton of daylight between Joe Kennedy and Ed Markey. And if you put them side by side, Markey's probably the more progressive one. It's about who represents, who the face of what voters want to represent them. And do they want to represent someone, to be represented by someone who they may like them on policy? But Ed Markey has been mauled for a long time with this idea that he's out of touch with Massachusetts. Some folks are claiming he, you know, lives in Maryland because he's in the state so infrequently. And Joe Kennedy is a very different style of politician. I think we have to wait to see what kind of race he wins. I think first we have to wait to see also how Elizabeth Warren is doing. It's very possible that even if Joe Kennedy does not challenge Ed Markey, if Elizabeth Warren ends up getting the nomination, he could very well be poised to take that Senate seat too. It's a situation where you have a lot of talented politicians out of Massachusetts, folks like Joe Kennedy and also other folks, Maura Healey, Ayanna Pressley, who are definitely on the rise, and not a lot of spaces for them to go.
Yeah.
So if you have an election coming up, I think that it would be silly for Joe Kennedy to not take it seriously, even if it would be a challenging race. I think we have to wait and see what the voters say.
All right. That's Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent. Thanks for joining us from New York, Kimberly.
My pleasure.
All right. Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, and Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald. You guys stick around. We're going to take a short break. Listeners, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to discuss corruption and incompetence in the government and the latest funding scandals at MIT. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. Still with us in Studio 3 is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, welcome back.
How are you?
I'm great still, thanks. Also with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Welcome back, Joe.
Sure, great to be here.
Let's move on and talk about competence and corruption in our state institutions. This week, federal agents arrested Dana Pullman, the former president of the Massachusetts State Police Union, and Ann Lynch, the group's Beacon Hill lobbyist. Joseph Bonavolanta is head of the FBI Boston Field Division, and he says Pullman embezzled from his fellow troopers.
We believe Pullman wielded the union like a criminal enterprise, running it like an old school mob boss, conspiring with Lynch to steal tens of thousands of dollars from its members and the Commonwealth.
Meanwhile, over at the RMV, a state oversight board fired Thomas Bowes, Merit Rating Board Director at the Registry of Motor Vehicles. He's the second official to leave the RMV in the fallout from a fatal crash allegedly caused by a driver whose license should have been revoked. The decision was made during the oversight board's first meeting in years. Here's Bowes speaking at that meeting before the board voted to fire him.
I take full responsibility for the role my department played in this event. I agree with the findings of the Grant Thornton report, which outlines the multiple failures in the registry system.
All right, listeners, call us. What are your reactions to these two events? Do you have concerns about how our state institutions are functioning? Is this something endemic going on? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so to our panelists, what is going on?
I think it's hearkening to the old days of Massachusetts as being a corrupt institution. While the state police scandal, the new one, isn't so much a government thing, this is the latest in a series of scandals at the state police. And, you know, the fact in the RMB one, I think, is even more serious. A lot of people are very upset about that. A lot of people in Massachusetts are very worried about the state being liable for the deaths of those seven people in New Hampshire because of what happened, because of their missing the driving record of the alleged assailant. So, you know, I think this is very serious, and I think it's bringing us back to the, like I said, the old days of Massachusetts being corrupt.
So, Renee, is this a return to the bad old days?
You know, I mean, what does it say that this oversight committee had not met for years?
And it's supposed to meet regularly,
right? That's true.
Right?
Exactly. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know about what's going on at the RMV. I think overall, at this point, there's a kind of stench of institutional rot and malfeasance that's starting to seep into state government here. You know, it should not have taken the deaths of seven people for the RMV to start to clean up its mess. And I think residents have a right to be upset about this. Lives were put at risk and lives were lost. So we have to see what's going to come of this. But you knew that it wasn't going to end with one driver who should never have been on the road. It's just sort of blossoming and becoming something else entirely.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, this stench imagery, Joe, is really strong. I suppose you could hear somebody out there arguing, listen, state police, RMV, they're just a couple pieces of government. The government is a big thing, state government. Do we have something more endemic going on here, or is it possible we have two exceptions?
That would be Charlie Baker arguing that it's just separate, you know, no big deal here, no worries about government. But in fact, we've seen a number of things recently in Massachusetts politics and Massachusetts government like this, and it's not inspiring great confidence. And, you know, Renee mentioned the fact that the board hadn't met. It's true. But, you know, also, you know, Attorney General Moore Healy was on that board, or her representative was on that board. Why weren't they raising the question of why aren't we meeting after all these years? So it's not just the RMV that's at fault for that.
Yeah. You know, Renee, that does. I found that very striking. So I've served on a lot of nonprofit boards over the years in my career. And if we weren't meeting, I would raise the flag on that. I would say, wait a minute, we're supposed to be meeting. And yet it sounds like what Healy's office has been saying is, hey, no one asked us to meet. Where is the onus in governance and oversight to make sure that it's actually happening?
Well, I don't know in that circumstance that you wait to be asked. If you're on the board and the board isn't meeting, you do raise a red flag and say, why aren't we meeting? Why aren't we doing our job? And in not doing our job, what's getting out of control? What aren't we looking at? So I think, you know, that's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of buck passing at this point. Well, we wanted to be asked. We wanted this. The bottom line is that lives were put at risk.
Yeah.
Because all of these different people were not doing their job.
Let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. William from Revere, go ahead.
Hi. So I just wanted to, and I know your panelists were just bringing it up. I really just wanted to hear more about what role we feel that Governor Baker has in all of this. It seems like he's the head of the executive. He's the one kind of, you know, in charge of all these institutions. And I agree, it does seem to be coming endemic. And, you know, the buck stops with him. So I'd just love to hear a little bit more about that. Thanks.
Let's do that, William. Thanks. So, Joe, you're the one that raised Charlie Baker. Yeah. Do you want to answer William's question?
I mean, this is the latest argument that Baker has been making. He's been making this argument constantly that, oh, it's not my fault, that it didn't start with me, that these weren't, you know, has this happened before my administration got here? But the fact is that the Baker administration hired this guy, Thomas Bowes, who was forced to resign. And it's unclear what his credentials were, what his qualifications were. He's a Braintree city councilor, town councilor. And so he obviously had some kind of political connections. Was this a patronage hire by the Baker administration? We don't know. There should be a full investigation of that. And, you know, I think that bakers should take more responsibility.
So, Renee, I want to talk about Thomas Bose for a minute. His lawyer has essentially argued, listen, this was a system-wide failure, and you're scapegoating Bose by firing him. I think a counter-argument might be, but you were the one in charge, and you chose not to execute on the backlog. So what is the tension between accountability for an individual further down the food chain and scapegoating so that the system itself doesn't have to be confronted and corrected?
Well, I mean, look, do I think other heads will roll before all is said and done? Absolutely. But it's really a false argument to be running around saying, yeah, but he wasn't in charge and he wasn't the person who's only responsible and he's a scapegoat. He was the guy. You know, he has to be held accountable. So I don't think arguing about, you know, whether or not he should be accountable or not, that's a false argument. You know, he wasn't doing what he was hired to do. As for the governor, you know, remember, he's the most popular governor in the country, we keep being told. How is it even possible at this point?
Yeah.
Because this is on him. This is on his watch. He, you know, he loves to take credit for things that go well. Well, things aren't going well right now in major agencies. What is he doing about it other than trying to make it seem like, well, this was the way things were before I came in? He's been in office too long now to get away with that argument.
Joe, we're hearing an increasing set of comments sort of expressing incredulity that neither Governor Baker nor Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack knew any of this was going on in the RMV. You know, is there covering going on there? Did they not know? Does it concern you if they didn't know? How should Massachusetts voters be thinking about that piece of this?
I think they should be thinking like they should have known more. Maybe they shouldn't know exactly. Maybe the governor, it's true, shouldn't be personally aware of every little thing that goes on in government. But this was an important piece of business that the RMV does to check the records of drivers from other states. It's very critical that they do that. It's a public safety function. And the guy that the Baker administration hired had no public safety credentials to deal with this. And, you know, it's unclear how this guy got his job. So there should be an investigation as to how he got his job.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Sylvia from Weymouth, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hello. Obviously, what happened at the RMV is horrifying, but I'm surprised that nobody is more angry about the fact that not just this union boss for the state police, but the state police themselves were embezzling tens of thousands of dollars from us as taxpayers. And I can't believe they were able to just retire. And some of them got their pensions. They stole from us. That is what they did when they pretended they worked overtime. They didn't work. This is disgusting. And I, you know, what happened at the RMV is horrifying again, but we should be more angry and these police should be held accountable. That is taxpayer money that they stole. That's not, there's no other word for that.
Sylvia, we're losing you. Your line's cutting out, but I appreciate the invitation to shift focus. So let's follow Sylvia's path and do that. So we've got two things going on with the state police. The one this week is about corruption in the head of the state police union and the state police union's lobbyist. Sylvia was also referring to the ongoing investigation of overtime corruption in the state police. Should we be thinking about one is worse than the other, Renee? Or where do we situate the state police scandals in this larger landscape?
You know, I think they're both terrible. I think with the state police, it's just this sense of this sort of drip, 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 month after month. You know, where does it end? Is it going to end? And how do they get to the bottom of all the problems that are going on with the state police? You know, there was the massive scandal that was going on before and continues to be ongoing. And now you have this. So what is wrong with the agency? You know, and how long? You know, what does it do for public trust in the state police and how they do their business? And how they police this state. I think it's the fact that this has been going on for so long, and every time it feels like you pick up the paper, there's something else that's been happening. I think it's more than people want to deal with at this point.
So, Joe, we spoke with legal analyst, WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner this week. She says this drip-drip actually, because we continue to investigate, is kind of business as usual, even though those two things aren't connected. Let's listen.
The scandal about overtime led them to look more closely into the state police union, you know, and uncover these charges. So in that regard, it's connected, but it really is not related to the overtime scandal. The overtime scandal, individuals have pled guilty for wrongly taking overtime money to which they were not entitled. And that's going on a separate track.
So you sort of pull a thread, then you follow another thread. How many threads might there be out there?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The caller said that she was concerned that people weren't paying enough attention about this, about the scandal at the state police. But in fact, people have been indicted in that case. So at least something is being done about it. Unfortunately, a lot of troopers, I think, are going to get off with just retirement and not pay the price for it. But it's been, this is one case where it has been going on for a long time, and people should be, the people of Massachusetts should be demanding better from their state police.
I'm going to want to shift gears one more time, but before I do, let's take a couple more calls. Adelino from Cumberland, Rhode Island. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you for your time. I would like to let everyone know that in Rhode Island, we also have corruption, and it's just that we've had such a veil of distraction and these policies that leave windows open for corruption. And as a citizen, I really would like to do more. And I think we should all open our eyes more so this veil of corruption is lifted from us so we can live peacefully.
Adelino,
thank you for your time.
I love that. It's kind of sad, but I love that note of solidarity. Thanks for calling in from Rhode Island and boosting us a little. Let's take Bill from Cambridge as well. Bill, go ahead.
Hi. Like you said, this is Bill from Cambridge. This could be a product of people saying, oh, it's a state job. Once you get in, you don't have to do anything. You know what I mean?
No, say a little bit more, Bill.
Well, you know, people joke about, well, once you get into a state job, it's really not that you don't really have to do much of anything. You just collect a paycheck and
got it.
And there's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Thanks, Bill. So what about this question of complacency? Should we be structuring state employment differently? Is complacency an issue, Renee?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of state government is bloated. And so you end up having all these layers, and it's easier and easier to get away with the kind of malfeasance we're starting to see. You know, however, you know, people still take for granted that these agencies are doing the right thing and looking out for people's best interest. And what they're finding out is it's kind of like this tick that's embedded in the skin. You can't just sort of pull it out and think you've gotten it. It goes down, you know, layers and layers. And you never have a sense of when you're getting to the bottom of it and is it really being done. At the same time, you have leaders who are saying, well, I didn't know what was going on. That's not an answer. You now do know what's going on. What are you doing about it?
All right. So, Joe, I'm going to put a little burden on you because I want to have maybe just one question on our last subject. And I'm going to build on this. Did you or did you not know what was going on question. MIT this week had resignations from two prominent faculty at their media lab who were upset by the university and the media lab's decisions to take money from the late Jeffrey Epstein, who has been accused, was previously convicted and newly accused again of sex trafficking and prostitution with girls. What is the obligation of a university to care about, know, vet, and do something about the people who are giving the money they need to do their work?
I think the university has a big obligation to know where the money is coming from, what sources are coming from. But in fact, it's kind of a dirty little secret of university fundraising, and especially of the MIT Media Lab, that a lot of this money is coming from the corporate world and from rich people, influential people. Companies like Exxon, Mobil were donating to the MIT Media Lab. Saudi Arabia had connections to the MIT Media Lab. So this is not just a, you know, fundraising coming in from ordinary people, but that's in fact how they do business now, how universities do business now.
Renee, let's listen to a quick clip from Jim Keenan, a professor at Boston College and author of University Ethics, Why Colleges Need a Culture of Ethics. Let's listen.
We cannot constantly say that the ends are great and wonderful and helpful and maybe even redemptive. But I do think that the question of source really has to be addressed, and the Epstein case is highlighting that yet again.
So this scandal is spreading. Harvard, MIT, I suspect we're going to see more. Professor Keenan used the word redemptive. Where does redemption come in for universities now as they begin to look at sources of this kind of funding?
I think we want to believe that some great lesson has been learned from this. And I don't believe it has. You know, it's not like MIT's Media Lab did not know who Jeffrey Epstein was. If you were taking money from Jeffrey Epstein in 2013, you knew that he was a convicted sex offender.
In 2008.
In 2008, right. So it's as simple as this. What Epstein did to young girls wasn't as important to the school as what he could do for them. That's what it came down to. They could say things now, it was a mistake in judgment. What was the mistake? You took money from a convicted sex offender. You knew he was a convicted sex offender. If he had not gotten arrested again, MIT would still be sitting fat on that money.
All right. So I want to shift gears. I want to make sure to leave some time for hubbubs, which are those brief stories or event that caught our attention. But we got to do the lightning round on this. So, Renee, lightning round. What's your hubbub?
Hubbub. It is time tomorrow for the annual Boston's annual Caribbean Carnival. It is a great event in Roxbury. Music, food, calypso, steel drums, the best costumes you've ever seen. Get over there. It's one of the best times you could have in the city.
That sounds awesome. How about you, Joe?
Yet another study showing Massachusetts has one of the worst highway systems and worst highway programs in the country. I know, yet another study. This is one by the Reason Foundation. That's not surprising. The surprising thing to me is that Stephanie Pollack, the transportation secretary, continues to stand up there and say, oh, no, it's not true. We actually have a good transportation system here, and we're investing tons of money in it. So they continue to defend themselves. I think that's a bigger surprise.
All right. So my hubbub is that Celtics great Bob Cousy received the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the White House yesterday. He played with the Celtics for 13 years, starting in 1950. He coached at Boston College later. He's a Celtics legend and a 13-time All-Star. He also spoke with regret in his later years, he's 91 now, for not better supporting his African-American teammates, especially Bill Russell, during the Civil Rights Movement. He was the 10th award recipient of Donald Trump's tenure and got it personally from the president yesterday. Well, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks for coming in and joining Recon Review this week.
Thank you.
And with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist. I did it.
Yay.
At the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. So stay with us because coming up, it turns out we have coral in New England. Who knew? And could that coral help mitigate the impacts of climate change on other coral reefs? As you can imagine, we are going to find out. I'm Tiziana Deering. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and with me in Studio 3 is Barbara Moran, editor of Earthwild, WBUR's environmental team, for the first of what we hope is going to be a regular check-in. Barbara, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. And you're bringing some news that really surprised me. There is coral off the waters of New England.
Right. Who knew, right?
I did not know.
Nobody knows this. It's an amazing story. I love this story. So when I heard about this coral, I started asking around about it, and I talked to one of the scientists who studies it. Her name's Randy Rosian. She works at BU. And I want to play you what she said to me because it's hilarious. So this coral is commonly called the Northern Star Coral. And when I asked her about it, she calls it the scientific name Estrangia, which is also funny because it's like a strange coral. But here's what Randy said.
When we started working on this coral, and still, although less so now, people would be like, what? A stranger what? A stranger who? What are you saying? There's a coral in New England?
So tell me a bit about this Northern Star Coral. It's a nice name. What does it look like?
Well, I guess it depends who you ask. To me, it's kind of ugly, right? So if you out of the water, it looks like basically like white slime on a rock.
Okay? Gorgeous.
In the water, it looks like a small anemone.
Anemone.
Looks like one of those things with little fingers. And it's usually yellow or brown or white. I should also say that scientists who work on it do not agree with me about my assessment of its looks.
About the aesthetics.
Yeah, exactly. I spoke with Cody Sharp, who studies this coral at her lab at Roger Williams, about her love for the coral. And here's what she said about it.
I would say it's extremely photogenic. Not at first. When you look at it, it's just a what looks like sort of a tiny little rock, but if you give it a minute and you look up close, you can actually see a lot of fine detail, and there's a beautiful animal, actually tons of beautiful animals on a single colony, and so maybe I would say its most redeeming feature is that it holds a lot of secrets, and it's sort of a quiet hidden gem.
Okay, well, that makes it sound very cool.
Yes.
And we will get into those secrets. But first, on the color, this coral is white. I thought that was the same thing as being bleached, which is bad.
Yes, exactly right. So that is the great thing, or one of the great things about this coral. Right. So corals live with little organisms in them. And what these little organisms do is they make sugar and they feed that to the coral in exchange for a place to live. And these little organisms are called symbionts, right? And if the water gets too hot for too long, the symbionts get up and leave, right? And the symbionts are what give corals all of their brilliant colors. When the symbionts leave, the corals look white, or what they say, bleached, okay? So I learned all that for the story too. So the great thing about the Northern Star, this is amazing, is that it can survive bleached. Like if the symbionts leave, it can survive. And sometimes it looks bleached, but it's totally healthy. And nobody understands totally why. They know that this Northern Star can feed itself in the water a little bit, but that's not the whole story. And nobody knows the whole story about how it's able to survive bleaching.
Okay, but to this point of survival, I was so surprised to hear about this coral because I didn't think they could grow this far north. I assumed it was too cold.
I know, that's the other amazing thing about this coral. I love this coral. It's like the toughest coral ever. So it can survive. It has this huge range all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and as far north as Buzzards Bay. And that's what really differentiates it from tropical corals. Most tropical corals can only survive in this very narrow temperature range. But our coral, our tough little New England coral, can handle anything that New England throws at it. They sort of cold winters and the hot summers, and it can totally take it. Randy Rosian, that coral scientist at BU, here's what she said about it.
So just like us, it has to handle cold winters and hot summers. It has to handle shifts in what the ocean does during those seasons, including changes in nutrients. We know that it goes quiescent in the winter, actually. It kind of gets dormant and shuts down for a little while. But it hunkers down just like we do, right? But it can handle so much because it's of where it lives.
That is like us in the winter. That is
except
fair.
I eat all winter,
there
right?
There you go. Fair enough. So why are scientists taking a closer look at the Northern Star right now?
Yeah. So as you know, coral reefs, tropical coral reefs, the ones that most people think about when they think about coral reefs, these beautiful reefs like the Great Barrier Reef that are all these different colors and these huge ecosystems, they are in big danger from climate change. There was a big study from the UN that came out last year and said that if the Earth warms by 2 degrees Celsius, virtually all of these tropical reefs are going to die.
Wow.
And it's already bleaching a lot. So they're in a lot of danger. So there's scientists all over the world sort of looking at different ways to help these tropical reefs survive or bring them back from bleaching or stress. And that's what these guys are doing in New England.
So how could our Northern Star coral help with that?
Well, one of the cool things we talked about this coral being able to hunker down in the winter and sort of come back in the spring, Cody Sharp, the scientist at Roger Williams, says they want to really look at that. And that may help them figure out how to help tropical corals bounce back. And here's how she described it.
We do think of this emergence from the wintertime to the spring here in Rhode Island as sort of analogous to recovery from bleaching or distress in the summertime in the tropics. And what we want to do is learn how these corals do it naturally up here in the hopes that there may be some kind of tools or some kind of management strategies that we can transfer to helping tropical corals recover from these really severe sustained warming events that they're now facing.
Okay, so how far along are they in that? What's the process look like? And, you know, we talked about secrets in these coral. How do you get coral to reveal their secrets?
Right, you have to be a coral whisperer.
Yes.
So it is a lot of work. And it's really great to think that our tough little coral might help these tropical reefs. So I went out for a day with Cody Sharp down in Rhode Island, and they dove for coral, and I watched the whole process. So they dive for this coral, they bring it up, and then they get out and they clean it up and they rush it back to the lab to get it back in time for it to spawn. Because sometimes corals spawn under stress, so they have to get it back to the lab before it spawns. So once they get it back, what she's trying to do is raise these coral from babies all the way to adulthood. And this has been done with some tropical corals, but it's never really been done with this coral. So I asked her, because it's really a ton of work to raise these corals from babies to adults. And I asked her, like, why bother, right? Why not just look at these adults? Why bother, you know, being a mom and having to raise all these babies? And here's what she said to me.
It is a lot of extra work to get gametes and to raise coral babies, but it's so worth it because in these earliest life stages, they are in some ways at their least complicated.
And because of that, she says you can really figure out how they work.
Getting these earliest life stages tells us a lot about when they first acquire the beneficial microbes that, that keep them alive and that we think are really important for their survival in the ecosystem.
So there's a lot of really basic stuff that scientists still don't understand about the biology of this coral, things about their metabolism, how they connect with those helpful microbes that help feed them. And Cody Sharp said having a whole family of little ones will really help the research move forward.
All right. Now, Barb, in New England, we're seeing our waters change because of climate change. An analysis of federal ocean data by the independent research nonprofit Climate Central found that waters off the coast of New England have warmed up more than any other coastal areas in the United States, which is stunning. That's up to 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1901. So I guess are scientists worried at all about the impacts of that on this northern star coral?
Yeah, that's a great question. This northern star coral has a very wide temperature range, and it's not endangered now. In fact, it's labeled as like least endangered species. But I asked Cody Sharp, the scientist, about whether they worry about it going forward. And she says, as far as I know, it has a pretty high upper temperature range, but they're not sure what will happen to it if the waters get warmer and warmer and warmer. So it's fine for now, but they're keeping an eye on it.
That's Barbara Moran, editor of Earthwhile, WBUR's environmental team. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We have our own coral, and you can actually find pictures of it, the Northern Star Coral, at our website, radioboston.org. I actually think it's kind of cool looking. You should go check it out. That is our show for today. Hey, thanks for joining us. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today from Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I am Tiziana Deering. Thanks for being here today, and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.